Well, the world is a dumpster fire. Nothing here makes sense. And you vacillate between crippling fear and constant self-defense. And nothing's right and nothing's good. And you're paralyzed with grief. Don't kill yourself, just have a cup of coffee.
Welcome to Coffee Over Suicide, the dramedy podcast about mental illness and choosing life over death one cup of coffee at a time. I'm your host, Chris Parker Howard. And today on the show, we have got filmmaker and old friend, Matt Nothelfer. His latest film, Flying Fur, he co-directed with his wife, and it is about animal rescue, and it is really fantastic, honestly. It's been winning awards all over the place, and there are links in the feed where you can see it, and I highly recommend you watch it. If you're a documentary person, if you're an animal person, this is going to be your sweet spot in the Venn diagram. But we get into that, and we get into a whole lot more in the conversation. As I record this, it is Thanksgiving. And I have a lot to be thankful for. We are at the penultimate episode of the season. That's right. Season 2 of Coffee Over Suicide is wrapping up at episode number 75. But don't worry, that doesn't mean that I won't be in touch with what's going on and what's happening, because I absolutely will. I want to thank everyone who stuck with me throughout this journey. This has been absolutely amazing, and I couldn't have asked for better support, better fans, better friends. And it really, honestly, it's been a joy doing this thing. And I can't wait for season 3 to come back. I've got some things in the works that are going to make season 3 actually a little bigger and better and stronger than the previous two, but I can't quite talk about them yet until ink is on paper. But that said, this episode is really a special one because Matt and I, we have a history, and that history goes back all the way to the 90s, and we do get into that to some degree. But much like my episode with Char Molina, I couldn't let the whole thing be about that. That's actually a whole other bucket of syrup. That maybe I'll have to dissect another time. But I kind of like the fact that this episode has us talking to somebody who is really pretty well adjusted for the most part. Not really a lot of mental health issues to speak of. And to me, that's actually kind of fascinating, because I know very few people that don't have something going on. And so I think for that alone, not to mention the fact that the story is incredibly positive, and it's one of inspiration. This is a person who's basically their whole life kind of just got up and made things happen. That's pretty outstanding. Again, you have to check out the film Flying Fur. There is a link below. You can go to flyingfurfilm.com and go watch it. It's really awesome. But enough of me yakking about this. This is my conversation with Matt Nothelfer. Are you still out and about touring this thing around?
In a sense, we are in a bit of a hiatus this time of year because Alicia and I kind of helped put together a film festival here in Southern California. So for the next 2 months, we're basically just doing that. And then once that's over, we're going to keep touring with it, especially around the Southern California region. Arizona, Nevada, taking it out to cities so people can see the story, you know, about animal rescue.
Well, take me back a little bit farther. Well, a lot, sure. A bit farther. I want to know some things, like how we get there. What was small, tiny Matt like? Where did you grow up?
Well, you know Hemlock, Michigan, yeah. A little bit. So
yeah, there's one stoplight, right?
Yeah. And when I first came into consciousness, there wasn't even that. There was just an intersection with a blinking light. So, yeah, it was a small town. It still is a small town. Farming community, mostly when I was growing up, kind of Mayberry-ish in a way. It's not so much anymore because it's just a bedroom community for that mid-Michigan Tri-Cities area.
But, yeah.
Yeah. So what was small Matt like?
Yeah. What do you do in a small town when you're little?
Oh, catch bugs, be fascinated by the world, listen to fascinating sounds, explore, dig things in the dirt, get into trouble, cut yourself, almost die a handful of times, just being a little scamp, those kinds of fun things, trying to interact with the neighborhood kids as best as I could. A lot of typical things, typical American things, riding bikes. My family, I have four brothers, and there was a lot of fun, definitely fun antagonism going on, and some not so much fun antagonism. So there was that. Now, we all love each other, but when you're growing up, it's, give me that toy back type of stuff. It's starting.
Yeah.
What were your
interests? Honestly, what were you leaning into? Like, as far as interests go, what was your main stuff?
Oh, as a little kid?
Yeah.
Play and being creative, definitely. Discovering things, exploring, trying to build things.
Was that pretty typical of everybody? Sorry, we just
no worries.
Was that pretty typical of everybody?
In my family, to an extent. I mean, play was a huge thing for us because, mom was my mom anyway was always like, just get the hell out of the house, go outside and play. And outside of like a certain range that we weren't allowed to go, we pretty much had free range. So, yeah, play was huge and just having fun with that. I mean, I think I was more inquisitive, maybe a little bit more introverted than some of my brothers for sure. But other than that, yeah, just having a good time out there in the world.
The world was really a different place before the internet came along to kind of keep tabs on everything.
Oh, my God.
There was so much mystery in everything because you didn't know anything.
No, and such a blessing because then, and it's not just, folks that do or do not have the internet, but when you're a kid, you just want to see how things work, if a bug has legs, do they just, can you pull them off the body of the poor? I tortured a few grasshoppers, I'm not going to lie.
Yeah.
Then catching butterflies when butterflies used to exist in large numbers and you just run around and grab them. It's really hard not to romanticize that time in my life because I'm always just looking back on it and definitely kind of building it up probably more than it actually was. But I do enjoy that part of my life for sure.
Well, to a degree, I imagine. But at the same time, there is something that you really can't quantify about the idea of wonder, the idea of how does this work? I used to joke that there's, like you take the song Twinkle Twinkle Little Star, it's ridiculous, but at the same time, right. It's so inquisitive. And I don't know if you'd get a song that simple and that, sweet and innocent anymore because it would just be Google what is a star, I got it. The end. It's like there's no poetry to answers sometimes. And there is poetry in the not knowing if you're a person who's open to that. And it sounds like you were really open to that.
Well, yeah, most kids are, I think. And, you know, being inquisitive is huge. And when you're ignorant on top of it, it just gives you the ability and just the wonderment, like you said, to explore and just find out how things happen. You know, like I said, digging in the ground and finding worms and grubs and, you know, what's all this stuff.
So when did
watching
you first
my grandmother,
start? You know. Oh, no, go ahead.
Well, I mean, I was thinking about, okay, digging in the ground, it made me think of my grandmother who had a victory garden because she lived right next door. She had a garden that she was always taking care of in the spring and the summer and the fall. And she would let me help her from time to time, you know, just picking insects off the plants, taking care of the tomatoes, digging in the ground, that kind of stuff.
Just really, really tactile. Like the world was so physical. Everything was physical. And we don't tend to think about things that way very much anymore.
No.
That's really strange.
No, and certainly not now that I'm like half a century into it. It's, you know, interaction with the world most of the time now because of my job, career, and just things is through the computer screen. And yeah, definitely find myself longing for the more tactile experiences.
Well, take me back to that. When did you first get introduced to using a camera?
Oh, that's a good question, because the first time that not just me, but my entire family got introduced to using the cameras when my dad basically took up photography as a hobby.
Really?
In the late 70s, early 80s, I want to say. So all of a sudden he started showing up with 35mm cameras, and he loved taking slides. Not just, you know, not print photographs, but slides.
Yeah.
So for a long stretch there, he would just take pictures of everything, and then we'd have our little shows at night. Instead of watching television, we put up a slide projector and a screen, and then we'd all laugh at ourselves how stupid we looked. And as kids, we thought it was the best thing in the world. And my dad loved it. He eventually built a dark room. He started developing his own slide film, started doing prints. And because of that, you know, I got interested into it as well. But yeah, man, that originally, just having a parent that was like turning you on to something cool and fun that everyone in the family was enjoying, that was great. And I mean, as a matter of fact, I still have every single one of those slides on my phone now.
Oh, wow.
So they were all digitized. And yeah, I still have them. My brother Mike did that for us.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, so, you know, not only do you have the memory of the slides, but the memory of the photograph context when it happens. So it kind of like triggers those little memory bubbles in your brain, and you kind of remember those days because you have a photograph of it.
So it was your dad.
Yeah, absolutely my dad. And then when I was a tween, 12, 13, he came home one day with a VHS film camera. So all of a sudden we were playing around with a video camera on top of everything else. And and that kind of really got me going. And yeah, I followed that through and into a career, actually. So.
Well, yeah, but I remember that, you know, you and your brothers used to make just the dumbest shit, like just all the time, though.
There
were all
these
videos coming out of nowhere and MTV parodies. And you had a public access show at one point, didn't you?
Oh, my God. Yeah, we can jump through time all over the place. But just because of what my dad offered us in the video camera, we knew we could do it. And we just bought like really cheap VHS systems, and we would smash edit things together with videotape.
VCR to VCR editing.
Yeah, as best you could manage it. And I'm sure some folks can relate to this as well. It's not only that, but, you know, in order to put a movie together really quickly, you would just edit the whole thing in camera. So you get one take and you hit the button, you do it, and then you move on to the next scene and the next scene and the next scene. That was super common. I think a lot of people did that.
Yeah.
But it's just too much fun. You know, I mean, that's how we would start to interact with each other in the world, and been doing it ever since.
Now, when I met you, it was probably the, let's say, like mid-90s.
That's right.
And it was, you know, I was a young punk kid. Like, literally, I thought I was this punk rock kid. And I got introduced to this goofy band. And my first impression was, I didn't get it at first. I didn't get it right away. I had to wait until the second time I saw Johnny Bravo and the Banana Convention featuring the Fabulous Toe Dollies. I had to see it twice before I understood what was going on. The first time it went completely over my head, because it was all these people in like 60s, 70s outfits playing bubblegum music at punk rock shows. Happily.
Yeah.
And trying to get people to sing and dance and clap their hands. And the first time I saw it, I just thought, you came to the wrong place. You're not in the right building. You're going to get killed. And then the second time I realized, oh, they want to get killed. Like, this is Andy Kaufman. This is great. This is performance art.
Well, I don't want to oversell it, but we were trying to just be goofy about everything, for sure, you know. Myself, Bill Barrett, Monty, my brother Marty, we were all there just kind of screwing around. And we were going to those punk rock shows in Saginaw, Michigan, and Jamestown Hall down in Flint. And they were a lot of fun, but at the same time, you know, they'd get pretty serious and kind of silly in that regard. So it's like, okay, let's take the piss out of this and let's just do something stupid. And the first thought was, we're just do like old TV theme songs. You know, and realize too, it's like at the moment we came up with that idea on a drive back from Flint, we were like, we don't really play instruments. How hard could it be though? Hey, let's try it. And we were terrible at it, obviously, but, you know, to compensate for how awful we were at playing music, we decided just to be silly about it all and just try to have a good time. And definitely kind of Andy Kaufman-esque, because, you know, he was around back then, and both Bill and I were enamored by what he was doing on Letterman and wrestling, so that all kind of added into it, and yeah, it was great.
And then eventually, I was, let's say lucky enough. I'll say lucky enough. I was lucky enough to get
generous.
roped in to this thing as the drummer. For probably just a handful of shows right around the end, around 1990.
Yeah, wasn't it like, it was like two or three shows, right?
Two or three shows, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was a Velvet Elvis show that I remember very, very distinctly, because it was, because it was the Banana Convention, it was Smiley Face, that was my punk band at the time. And the Rugby Mothers and like a handful of other bands, like punk rock bands. There was a metal band that was playing that night. There was a pop act and acoustic act.
Yeah, I remember
act.
That metal band. That was awesome.
Yeah. And they,
didn't the metal band have like an upside down cross with like strobes on it?
They did. Yeah, they completely did. Aseldama, I think, was their name. And they were really, really serious. And that made them hilarious, too. But the thing that I loved about it was that the job of all the bands that night was everybody had to learn an Elvis song. All the bands did, at least to a certain degree. You know, I think the metal band didn't take it quite as seriously.
No,
but it was fun. It was really interesting. It was totally strange, very avant-garde, and the mixed genre show is something that I really took for granted, you know, until years later when it was just, you know, everybody was wanting to stay in their own lane and it got kind of boring. You know, it was very,
yeah,
I didn't realize how lucky we had it to have all of that diversity in one night. It was really bizarre. Not a lot of overlap in the audiences.
No, not really. But I remember being fascinated by that too. And also grateful, because like, holy crap. I mean, there's just so much weirdness going on right now. Isn't this cool? the fact that, you know, it just kind of coalesced in a way with not like a hell of a lot of effort. It was just like, oh, let's give this thing a try. It was a lark, put together a show and mix it up and see what happens. And it did. And, you know, it was a slice in time where we can kind of get away with that. You know how the scene moves one way or another. But yeah, it was, I appreciate those days for sure. I mean, obviously I've never been a good musician, but just to be able to be up on stage and act silly was my main goal. So I was able to accomplish that.
I kind of always felt that way too.
Yeah. So always an imposter. So if I'm going to be up there messing around, let's at least try to do something interesting.
Yeah. My thought was, I don't know if I'm any good, but I know I'm good at this. I think I can do
I like
this.
And I also would love to point out, not that it makes a big difference, but after all these years looking back on it, it's like, you know, when you were drumming for us and when we would do shows, I'm pretty sure if we put together like a 30-minute rehearsal before we actually went on stage, that was miraculous. I don't really think that we ever did like any type of rehearsal seriously at all.
No.
Did we?
I think I had one. So. I had one rehearsal.
Maybe.
And it was at Bill's house.
Yeah.
And he gave me a bowling ball afterward.
I'm glad you remember that part.
Well, I just thought it was the weirdest thing because I didn't know anybody very well. I kind of knew people
and here's
from
your bowling ball.
Yeah, and it was like a parting gift. It was the strangest thing because it said Frank on it, and it had a tank. It was Frank the Tank, this blue bowling ball. It was 15 pounds. I didn't bowl.
Oh my God.
I asked him where he got it from, and he didn't know.
Was it? Oh, this is great because all of a sudden, you know, nostalgia and memory come flooding back. But wasn't it in like a white and blue bowling ball bag or something similar to it? Oh my goodness. I can remember these things.
Yeah.
Years. That's great.
But that was part of the greatness of that whole thing. And just to touch on this for just a moment longer. So like 10 years later, we get the group back together for a laugh. And then we decided to start writing some songs for a laugh. And you came in to produce the thing.
In a way, I think it was basically my brother told me he was doing it again. So I just kind of wanted to stave off adulthood even longer than I had up to that point and just, you know, be immature and stupid. And it was a great opportunity to kind of do that again. And, you know, I like being on stage acting stupid. I just enjoy doing that. So when the opportunity came by and it's like, oh yeah, we're doing this again. It's like, oh, can I, you know, maybe I can help out again and do this and do that. And, it was silly, but well worthwhile.
It's kind of weird. The things that we like, the places that we ended up going. I just kind of went over that DVD that you had shot, that kind of concert documentary, if you will, that you put together for us. And I just watched that the other day for the first time in maybe a couple of years. And I was really struck by how ridiculous it was that the roots of this thing were in a subversive joke. And we became an actual band.
There's worse ways to start a band, right?
Yeah, there really
are. It's necessarily the most unique origin story, to be honest. I mean, I do think when you're a kid, you're kind of doing things to, you know, give the finger to other people. But it was a lot of fun to do it and to see how it just kind of evolved and kept evolving and turned into things that we would have never imagined or desired in certain regards.
Yeah.
But it happened. And then it just, you know, and just would open up other opportunities. So, yeah, you know, lots of fun.
So tell me about when you first started to think about using your camera as a career.
Probably backing up into when my brothers and I were younger. I was a teenager and they were younger than I was. And my dad had that camera for about a year or so. And I would just have these long nights where I'd stay awake and just imagine entire like movies in my head. This shot, that shot, another shot. And then I could put this shot in there and then they could say this and they can do that. And, you know, that would keep me going through the day whenever I was at work or daydreaming at school or whatever. So that was kind of when I thought this is something that maybe I could do. And I never really took that part seriously until like my first year of college, after I went through a couple semesters and I realized what I was doing was not interesting to me. And I got turned on to the broadcast division of the local community college. And I found out that they were offering classes, and then that was it. So it's like, okay, I just shift everything over to that.
So there was really no plan B.
No. Because my plan B was originally my plan A, and I didn't like plan A, right? So yeah. Then it's like, well, I'm not. So I was basically trying to be an art student, graphic designer, things like that. And I could do it, but I realized that, one, I really didn't like doing it all that much, and two, everyone else was better at it than I was anyway.
Yeah.
So I was like, okay, let me angle towards this stuff then, because I like doing it. You know, it makes me content. It kind of feeds my creativity. And found out that I was marginally good at it because I was like putting more effort into it than I had other things in my life. So, yeah, just keep going with it.
You know, there's something that I've always found entirely fascinating about your family, just in general.
What is it?
And well, the thing that I've always found fascinating is that you really genuinely love each other. I mean, you don't think that's weird?
Well, I'll tell you this, Chris, I do think it's weird in a way. So, and by that, I mean, I grew up with this loving family and, I was well aware of that they were a loving family because, unfortunately, in my neighborhood, there's another family across the street that were the complete opposite. And, you know, they were problems for me in particular, because I got bullied by them all the time. And they were just, they weren't like completely cruel to each other, but they were cruel enough that it was, it affected me a lot. And yeah. It made me realize that what we had in our family was special. Now, at the same time, you're just a kid. You can only, you know, intellectualize and all this stuff so much. These are more like observation in retrospect than they were
sure,
you know, in the time. But, it was weird, but very much appreciated.
Yeah, because everybody seemed to turn out okay. I mean, I got to watch you interact with your brothers and your mom and your dad. I mean, God rest him. Your dad was really something.
Yeah, of course.
I mean, your parents were so omnipresent throughout a big section of my life.
They didn't
know me, you know, like but they took an interest in me. And they were around. I mean, I did stage plays and with your brother and, you know, all kinds of weird stuff. And they were always around. And, you know, they were just those people. And they knew, it seemed like, everybody. And they just had a soft
spot
for
everybody.
People.
Yes, they did. And that's, you know, and the weird thing is I don't have that capacity that they did,
right?
And they do, which I find incredible. And I'm always, my dad inspired me in that regard. My mom does too, as far as like trying to achieve that level of empathy with the world. They just did it naturally. It came easy to them in a certain regard. They loved their family and they loved what their kids were interested in. And because of that, they were around and supporting us all the time. Like, obviously, not just me, but my other brother, Mark, my brother, Mike, my brother, Marty, my brother, Monty, who you were hanging out with. And that's why you knew my parents. It's just, there's no doubt that they were very special. And my dad had that capacity just to be open and easy with people that, you know, a lot of human beings don't have. And I don't have it, and I wish I did a lot of times. So
I don't have that either, but I was always fascinated by it. I just thought, how do you, it seemed like a magic trick.
I was too. I'll tell you an anecdote. I mean, that's exactly how I felt about it. I remember one time, I must have been 5, maybe just 6. And again, this goes back to when I would just be outside, just mess around with stuff. And this time there happened to be a pencil on the yard, some fishing line for some god unknown reason. And one of the young sapling trees was growing in the front yard. And I just decided to make this weird contraption of fishing line, pencils, and I can't even explain it. And I was just like stringing stuff together, just being weirdly weird and creative.
Yeah.
And at the end of it, I finished, I stepped back and I went, what the, I remember this as a kid. I'm like, what the hell am I making here? This is stupid. This is the dumbest thing I've ever done.
Right.
And at that moment I looked up and my parents were looking at me through the window and they were like, just incredibly, like, you could see it on their faces. They were like super proud of me. And they're like, oh my God, look at what our son's created. It's so wonderful.
Matthew's going to be an architect.
And I'm looking at it going, this thing is a piece of, this is the stupidest thing I've ever done. But even at that young age, I realized that they were like super supportive, even when they probably even didn't need to be. But, you know, you have kids. It's hard not to be, and you admire what they're doing.
Yeah.
You know, because it's so fascinating. And that's just what my parents did throughout our whole lives, you know, just supported. You can attest to this. Like, for instance, when we talk about that band that we were in, my dad being around a lot, my mom being around a lot, you know, about easily 50 to 60% of that stuff. Now, let's be more generous than that. Let's say it's more like 80% of that stuff that we did would have never happened. Because he was behind the scenes making sure that we could pull it off. Whether that's helping out with logistics of things. He actually pitched in a couple of times with money to make stuff happen.
Yeah.
You know, these are the privileges that you get when you have family that is willing to, you know, give you that type of support. And believe me, I'm well aware of it.
Well, on that first tour bus. You know, that he basically came in and, you know, pimped the ride. Like, he just built tables and turned seats around and bunks and storage. And we turned that little yellow short bus into a tour bus for a band where you could hang out. I mean, it was amazing.
Yeah, you could actually live in it a little bit, right?
And we did.
He knew it. Yeah. I mean, I remember he'd show up. I think he told Monty, he's like, he showed up and he's just like, no, you're not going to be able to do that. He just started working. Right. Cause he knew, you know,
when I was moving to Denver, and I was leaving the band and things were really strange between me and everybody, for a lot of reasons. I mean, you know, some of it was on me being a horrible communicator of things. Some of it was on just that typical thing that happens in the city that we were living in, which was, you know, you're leaving, so now you don't exist. And it was kind of a strange time. It was kind of a really strange time.
Yeah.
But I do remember that your mom used to save the coffee from every hotel they went into because she knew I loved coffee. And so every time I would see her, she would have this giant Ziploc bag full of hotel coffee for me. And so when I was leaving, she gave me, I think probably about 10 pounds of hotel coffee. I'm not even kidding. And a coffee mug.
I know you're not. That's why I'm
right. And a coffee mug so that I'd have a mug to remember her by.
Yeah.
So I still have that mug. And your dad gave me his personal John Denver album. And he's out of his record collection and said, you know what? This makes me think of Denver, Colorado, and it brings me a lot of joy. And I hope that it brings you a lot of joy in Denver, Colorado. And I just thought that was the nicest thing. It was just the nicest thing. And they made me a card, you know, saying good luck and all that. And it was just amazing. And, you know, my own parents were like, what the hell are you doing? You're going to die.
Yeah, I mean, I can't even begin to articulate how they do it, because I don't know, maybe I'm a psychopath or something, but I wasn't born with it. And their ability to do those things and be so sweet to people. I really think it's effortless for them.
Yeah,
because they're genuine and they're engaged, and God bless them. I mean,
I think you had to have gotten a part of that, though, right? I mean, there's some of that in you there.
I mean, yeah. I'm not a complete bastard. but I'm just going to admit that I struggle with being nice, whereas they are they did it so elegantly and graciously, you know.
Well, tell me a little bit more about filmmaking. When did you get your first job making a film?
Well, when I first started getting paid for it, I was just doing like production assistant work. When I first made like a film, that would have been like way back in college too. Well, let's not call it a film. I was like making videos for people, whether that be like a wedding video or like. Another good example would be I made a video once for a local politician who was running for office, things like that. So that was always my career at the beginning. It was just doing like local, regional,
just freelance
stuff. Yeah, freelance. And I did that for forever. The first time I actually got paid to make a film, gosh, it wasn't that long ago, to be honest. Nope. So making a documentary about 5-6 years ago, again, you know, and that was on my own terms with my wife. But before that, it was all just freelance stuff.
I mean, that's pretty atypical as far as careers go. So all of it's really fascinating.
Yeah, man. I mean, I'll give you a quick rundown. So out of school, I got hired to basically do broadcasts. So I did that in the Deep South for a while. And then I got tired of doing that after 2 years, and I moved to Southern California. And that's where I started doing like this editing gig for a travel company. After 2 years of that, I decided to move back to Michigan, wherein I started doing corporate work, freelance, because I always wanted to be freelance. And I had a buddy who was doing corporate stuff in Michigan who said that they would hire me, and they did. They gave me a lot of freelance work. Simultaneously, I started doing freelance work with the company I just left in San Diego. So for that, all that time, like when we were redoing the band, I was able to be a part of it because I was a freelance guy, right?
Yeah.
And I could just bounce in and out as need be. So yeah, and that was my career for a really long stretch. And then once that all kind of dried up, I still do freelance, by the way. I mean, that's my thing. But my wife and I are trying to branch out and become legitimate, quote unquote, filmmakers, where we're making movies and getting paid to make those movies and getting paid by making those movies. It's a struggle, but that's what we're aiming for.
Well, this most recent one, Flying Fur.
Yeah.
I was able to actually just watch that today. And I got to say, the ending, you sucker punch me with a little bit with some sweetness that makes your eyes tear up because it's beautiful.
Thanks.
And I mean, it really is a compelling story. How do you come across a story like that and decide this is what I'm going to do?
Well, it's a little of both. You basically come across the story, and if it resonates with you, right, and you kind of feel like it's going to be a good story, you do tell yourself, this is what I'm going to do. And in this case, in this particular case with the movie Flying Fur, it's about animal rescue, about a pilot who flies to the deep south in his own plane, rescues dogs out of kill shelters, flies them up to the northeast where they get adopted into forever homes. And my wife discovered that story one day when she was out and about. And she knew that there was this little kernel of great storytelling in there, and she wanted to tell that story. She actually pursued the guy who is the pilot for, I don't know, 3 months, tried to convince him that it would be a good idea to do a movie. And she was relentless, and eventually he relented and said, all right, fine, let's do this thing. You guys seem like you know what you're doing. And he allowed us to tag along with him for about 3 weeks. And without her initiative and without her knowing and feeling like it was going to be a good story and something worthwhile to do, it would have never happened. And those are just things that are, you know, you're just going to feel like makes sense to you in the context of where you are in your life and what you can accomplish and what you want to do, all those types of things. I mean, let me ask you this. What type of projects have you done now and in the immediate past that you just kind of knew that was, you know, worthwhile to jump into with both feet?
Well, probably the strangest one was one that I knew was going to be the hardest for me. I was asked by a music producer to come in and help this 25-year-old girl write a record. And so I said, yeah, I can do that.
What made you think that to yourself, I can do that?
Well, I didn't think I could. That's why I told him I can do that. I really didn't know if I could or not. I wanted to see if I really was a songwriter. I wanted to see if I really had that in me, because this was something that wasn't really inspiring me. It was something I didn't know if I could connect with. And I had to find out, you know, if you're going to be a working musician, you have to be able to work. You can't just turn it on when you feel like it. You've got to be able to work when you don't feel like it.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
you're speaking the truth, brother.
I wanted to know if I could do that, because that matters. And so I spent a few months working with this girl. And we wrote this record, and it was kind of a throwbacky rhythm and blues kind of thing. She went to Muscle Shoals and recorded
the
Swampers.
No kidding. Awesome.
Yeah. And she said, hey, we can fly you in to play drums on this thing. Or we can spend that money to hire Aretha Franklin's horn section. And I said, why are you on the phone with me? Hire the horn section.
Horn section.
Yeah.
No offense. But
yeah, for real. And besides, let the guy at Muscle Shoals do his job. He's going to be fine.
Yeah,
no kidding. So it was a strange experience. It was a record where I helped write. I helped basically take her ideas and co-write all of the lyrics with her. Write or co-write all of the vocal melodies, and even write or co-write the music. I had no idea if I could do that. And it was basically me, her, and this music producer on piano who's, you know, played Carnegie Hall with Leonard Bernstein. And then me, punk rock guy.
I see what you're saying. And I feel, I mean, you do, I'm going to make an assumption that you kind of felt like, okay, I'm a bit of an imposter in this circle of people, right?
Yeah, completely.
But at the same time, like, I know you from our days together, and I know that you collaborate well, believe it or not. I mean, obviously, there were times like when we were doing stuff where everyone's at odds with each other. But at the same time, you were much more nurturing with like bringing along creative ideas than any of the rest of the band, I thought. At least that was my impression of it. So I,
well, that was my impression too. So, I mean, it's two against them now.
But I find it a little bit fascinating that you're being humble about it, because I know what I've seen with my own eyes, what you're able to accomplish working with people. Certainly you're swimming in a different pool than, you know, your crummy little basement in Saginaw, Michigan, but, you know, but I mean,
but it's the same thing in a lot of ways.
Yeah, it's the same. Exactly. So what did you ultimately learn from all that?
Well, I learned that I can do it, that discipline works, that, that pushing through works. And that you basically, all you have to do is come up with an idea and criticize it until it's better.
I'm pretty good at doing that.
Yeah. I mean, that's everything. I mean, that's the only way I know how to do it. But basically you just beat something into shape. You have to start somewhere though. So go ahead and start with garbage.
That's the craft of creativity too, right? I mean, but many, many times, you're going to find your inspiration along the way. And if you're just willing to what you said, just bang it out, you know, you'll get to where you need to go, and you got to kind of trust in that weird creative process in a way.
Yeah.
I mean, I do it all the time in filmmaking, especially documentary filmmaking, where you don't even know really what you're getting until you're kind of in the editing room and you've got no choice but to figure out how to kind of sculpt it into some type of thing that people can recognize, you know. And I totally get it, and I can see how you're doing the exact same thing with music.
Yeah, it can be challenging, but in in your process of getting all of these things together and trying all of these different projects, you know, when you're freelance, it is kind of up to you to go out there and get the work. It requires a bit of a drive, and it's not always up to you whether or not people are willing to hire you to work. So how do you handle the stress of something like that? Is that something that you handle well?
Yeah, I think I did inherit that from my father. He was pretty laid back and laissez-faire about come what may, about how things would happen in his life. And I do have like this weirdly inherent trust that things should work out well enough. That being said, I mean, you know, you go through these dry spells as freelancers where all of a sudden there's no work. And even if you're pounding on doors, there's still no work. And then all of a sudden a week later, you've got too much of it. You do have to be consistent, and honestly, it's been a little weird for us because my wife and I, as filmmakers, we're in this transitional phase where we're trying not to be work for hire. We're trying to be filmmakers to get paid to do our own work, and it's a weird balance because, you know, you got to take care of bills, you got to pay for things, you got mortgages you got to take care of, and, you know, real life and what you want to do are not always compatible. So you struggle in that regard, but I'm always hopeful and optimistic somehow, some way. And even though it's stressful and it can be hair pulling at times, it's corny, but I'm always like, tomorrow's going to be a better day. It's like, you know, even if it's not, I'm always thinking that tomorrow's going to be a better day. And it's hard to do that sometimes, but I do that. And that helps a lot.
It does. It's a way of almost manifesting your own reality.
Yes, yes. You're going to build, you know, your own little bubble of reality one way or another. So at a certain point, especially, man, as you get older in life, it's like you're going to let that all those weird little things that used to bug you fall away, and then, you know, start concentrating on more of the positive things. Hopefully. Yeah.
Well, it's been an absolute blast talking to you about all this stuff and catching up on the old days and all of that. And I can't thank you enough for talking to me today.
Oh, thanks, man. I really, really appreciate it. And I'm really hopeful that we have a chance to collaborate again in the future, because I don't think we're done yet.
No, I don't think we are.
There's other things to do, you know. You never know.
You never know. Thanks for talking to me.
Thanks, Chris. Appreciate it.
And there you have it. Wasn't that a great conversation? He's a really good dude. He's super laid back. Nothing really seems to get to this guy. That is something I definitely aspire to. If you haven't yet checked out the film, and what are you doing? Turn this off and go watch it. FlyingFurFilm.com. It's an amazing documentary. What else can I say about it? It's awesome. Prove me wrong. But that's it for this week, folks. I really appreciate everybody sticking around until the end here. And again, go check out the Rise of the Kung Fu Dragon Master Kickstarter of previous guest Chris Mancini. You still got a couple more weeks before that goes out of reach. But as always, don't kill yourselves out there.